To start the ball rolling, let me invite our first speaker who's going to present to discuss global science question through international collaboration. Let me invite Dr. Carl Erb, Director of the Office of Polar Programs at the National Science Foundation, to give his views. Dr. Erb.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon. I hope the coffee was strong, and I'll try to keep you awake. I have 10 to 12 minutes, and if I understood my assignment correctly, it's to give some examples of how international cooperation under the Antarctic Treaty has enabled us as scientists to address issues that we couldn't have addressed otherwise, either singly or in the absence of the treaty. So I took the liberty of changing my title just a little bit, but I hope it's consistent with what you're expecting from me. Much of the research that I'm going to talk about is focused on understanding Antarctica's role in the global climate system, but not all of it, not by a long stretch. And when I say climate system, I don't mean just physics and chemistry. I mean life science, the whole system interaction that makes the world work the way it does. That's, I think, the central question of our age, how the world works, how environment's changing, how climate's changing. And it echoes through the themes of this conference. Science interacting with diplomacy, science as a source of policy, science is an early warning device, and of course, science is a quest for fundamental understanding. The researchers that we all support and the researchers who do the work are very much tuned in to that focus these days. We find that more and more. Just for example, a polar ecologist was visiting us at the National Science Foundation recently, and she said, and I think this is almost exactly a quote, "We are ethically obligated to stay ahead on climate change." She's looking beyond her science to the broader communities who need to understand the science in order to make intelligent and rational decisions about how to react. So, I think my first slide, let's see if this pointer works. Goes back quite a ways in time. We know that the Antarctic Treaty, of course, didn't invent science in Antarctica, but its provisions have fostered international sciences in very powerful ways. So, for example, during the Cold Wars, and our chairman just alluded to cooperation during the 1950s, the United States and the Soviet Union exchanged scientists who worked together in Antarctica. At first, the pattern was simply to exchange scientists, have each other's scientists join parties. But then it grew to involve projects with detailed planning involving both countries, shared logistics, interactive science. Later, in 1981, Soviet icebreaker served as a research platform for 13 American and 13 Russian scientists working together aboard the Mikhail Somov. This ship went far into the ice-infested regions of the Weddell Sea. It was the first deep penetration of that sea since Shackleton's famous voyage in Endurance in 1915-16. The result was the first comprehensive data set obtained in winter sea ice. A decade later, the Russian icebreaker Academic Fedorov and the U.S. icebreaker Nathaniel B. Palmer collaborated in the same region to establish a drifting camp on sea ice. 17 Americans and 15 Russian scientists collected data for 4 months on that project, looking at the Weddell Gyre, which we now know is a key constituent of climate ocean circulation. During this voyage, incidentally, the Soviet Union transformed itself into the Russian Federation. That happened while the ship was deployed, but the Antarctic research carried on, as far as we know, without a hitch. A good example of how the Antarctic Treaty has fostered international cooperation in the scientific endeavor. This slide shows a very, very striking growth since 1980 on the left-hand side up to 2004 on the right-hand side of the number of papers published in peer-reviewed journals that had authors from more than one nation, multinational authors. Let me give you some statistics drawn from that graph. The number of treaty parties during this period of time roughly doubled from 12 nations to 28 nations, but the number of international papers went up by a factor of 13. Factor of 13, from 15 papers in 1980 to 190 papers in 2004. The other striking aspect of this statistic, and this is taken from a very recent publication coming out of Norway, the authors are shown there, is that the bibliographic data shows that papers with international authors, with multinational authors, are cited in the literature much more frequently than papers with just one author. And so I think it's reasonable to suppose that such papers actually have a bigger impact on science than those written by scientists in a single nation. Just a supposition, but it's tempting to think about that. So let me now give you just a very few examples in the remaining minutes of multinational science projects. I'm going to select from ones that we know something about. So forgive me for the fact that many of these involve U.S. collaborations. Of course, Antarctica is mostly covered by ice, so a lot of these will have to do with ice. There's the continent. One of the big issues highlighted in the last IPCC conference was lack of information on the ice sheets in Greenland, Antarctica, tidewater glaciers are likely to do as far as sea level rise is concerned. And so this figure shows some of the major ice streams that are draining Antarctica. Up here, if you can see that pointer, I hope you can, the Chinese have an effort called PANDA. Over here, I believe Norwegians are making measurements. I'll come back to this blue ellipse in a moment. French-led effort down here. UK, US effort over here. In order to get a picture of what's happening to this huge continent, all these countries have to collaborate together, and they are. They have plans to exchange data. They're providing logistics support to each other. And that's really what it's all about. So now let's look at this oval area, something different. There also is a mountain range, as most of you probably know, in Antarctica. And most of you probably also know that mountain range is not supposed to be there. People who understand how mountains are built say there's no mechanism that could have created a mountain at that point in Antarctica, but it's there. So there's an international effort to try to learn more about that involving the UK, Russia, Germany, China, Australia, and ourselves in the UK using some very innovative technology. Next project is called ERISA. It takes place along the Antarctic Peninsula. Involves Argentina, Belgium, Korea, Ukraine, U.S. Of course, the Larsen Ice Shelf broke up, and what that enables us to do now is to do several things. To look at the marine ecosystem that now is accessible, that's fundamental science, but it also lets us study how ecosystems evolve as their physical environment changes. But it also lets us look at the ocean floor to get a history looking back in time of early behavior of the ice sheet. Now, as the ice mass on the Earth, on the continent, decreases, the continent's going to rebound. It's being pressed down by the ice. It's now going to rebound as the ice recedes. And in order to understand that effect, something like 5, 10, 15, 20 countries have combined into this coordinated international program called PolNet to measure the uplift of the continent as the ice mass decreases. Another project, again internationally coordinated through SCAR, as many of these others have been, involves all these countries, something like a dozen countries, taking ice cores throughout the continent to get an understanding of how the gases trapped in the atmosphere have evolved since just before the Industrial Revolution and on to present times. I'm going very quickly. I'm just trying to give you a quick sense of all the different, not all, many of the different collaborations that are going on. Another one looking farther back in time, 20 million years ago, 30 million years ago, to understand the history of Antarctica. German, Italy, Italian, New Zealand, UK, US collaboration, looking at sediment cores. And also, a lot of studies are looking upward. So this is a very novel, very interesting instrument developed by the French Space Agency. It's flown, dropped from balloons, and measures the constituents of the air column on the way down in real time. And it's being launched from McMurdo Station, but also from Concordia Station, the French-Italian station on the high plateau, which now allows me to turn in the remaining 2 minutes or so, Mr. Chairman, to just a few pictures of the kind of infrastructure sharing that makes projects like this possible. This is an Australian Airbus that flies as part of a logistics pool that a number of countries share, and it's a growing phenomenon in Antarctic science, air pools, air transport pools on both sides of the continent. C-130s are becoming more common on the ice. Here's a New Zealand wheeled C-130 and a U.S. ski-equipped 130 that provide scientists with range all over the country again, all over the continent again, networked as part of international collaborations. Swedish Icebreaker has been doing wonderful service in the Arctic. A few years ago came to the Antarctic, has supported a number of exciting joint research cruises, but I also want to take this opportunity to point out that on its maiden voyage, it included teachers from Sweden, from Chile, and from the U.S. who interacted with their classrooms in multilingual fashion. And at least here in the U.S. and in nearby classrooms, I know many, many young kids were very, very excited to hear what the Spanish-speaking scientists, the Chileans, were doing in Antarctica. So finally, a concluding slide. Those are the flags of the original signatories. The newest member of the family, of course, is Monaco. We were honored to have His Serene Highness Prince Albert open this conference. That's the new South Pole Station. And so let me just conclude by commenting that research at the frontier of science certainly can get done by individuals working alone or with pairs of scientists from two countries. But when complicated logistics partnerships like these are required, you have to go to a different model. And the treaty really makes that model possible, I think it's fair to say. We'll hear more about that from the other speakers in this session. I'd also like to acknowledge the role of the International Polar Year and the International Council of Science and the World Meteorological Organization, which generated so much additional enthusiasm for these partnerships, such that now well over 60 nations contributed and worked together during the International Polar Year. So it's clear that Antarctica is a model for international cooperation. There probably isn't anything more I can say on that topic, so I'll stop. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Carl, for your excellent lecture. Thank you from the International Board. Oh. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.